Welcome to the U.S. Chamber of Cannabis Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Goddard. I go by The Professor. And thanks for joining us today, everybody. Now, in this episode, we have a hell of a guest on the show ready for you. A man who truly embodies the idea of a jack of all trades and master of some. So let me take a moment to introduce what I like to call the screen-saving heavyweight champion of the world, a software engineering wizard, and the current CEO of Green Goddess Supply, the owner-operator, and they are a supplier of premium quality smoking accessories and home grow products. A big welcome to Eric Rochebeau to the show. Thanks for joining us today, Eric.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Pleasure being here. Thank you for having me. Quite an introduction. But yes, there's quite a history of, actually, I would just, this is my mouse pad, the old D3D.
Because
I used to work with FormGen and 3D Realms, and we did a Duke Nukem 3D screensaver and add-on pack back in the 90s.
Back when you hunted Creative Labs sound blaster cards whenever you needed an upgrade. Yeah.
There you go. Exactly.
So just to ask, did I destroy your last name? Is that the right pronunciation?
A little bit, but it's the name is Robichaud, but it's a French Canadian name. But yeah, with a name like Robichaud, I'm used to it. I've heard it all, but it's Robichaud.
Robichaud. Sounds good. Always good to learn that. Well, before we get into the main element, I like to run a little segment I call the High Five. Five quick questions concerning cannabis. So seems like you're ready. We'll kick right into it. Number one, I actually have six here, actually, because I computer nerd out pretty hard. So we're going to get into it. Definitely.
There you go.
What's your favorite way to consume cannabis?
Glass pipe.
Glass flavor. Yeah. Beautiful. So flower is the way.
Flower. Yes. If you're looking at, yes, flower. I mean, obviously I have, and I continue to do it all. I do pre-rolls. I do, roll an old joint, bongs, rosin, resin, dabs, been there, done that. But good old fashioned flower. I like to grow my own, and then I just pack a bowl and go. That's my favorite.
All right. That's home recipes are the best. So what's one of the most potent strains you ever consumed? It could be by labs, because I know a lot of people have high scores, but I'd say the experience is usually the better way to judge.
So obviously, they like the old saying, you never forget your first. I got to say, because, you have zero tolerance and so forth. And I jumping off the deep end. I didn't know it at the time. It was a Gorilla Glue 4 with my first time ever, never smoked. I mean, that just like punched me in the face, and I had problems with insomnia. I had actually gone to my doctor, and it was so bad. I went to the doctor and I got a prescription. This was back like 20 years ago, got a prescription for, I forget which one it was, but either Lunesta or Ambien, but whatever it was. And the side effects were awful. I couldn't do it. So then I went back to him, and he switched me to whatever the other one, so whichever one we did first, and we tried the other one. That was just as bad. And the side effects were awful. I felt like I was in a haze all the time. And I finally was like, I can't do this. I literally can't. This is worse. I'll just suffer the insomnia. And then, so that was like a current, theme at the time when, we had a party, like a 4th of July party at my house, and a friend was like, oh, you have insomnia problems here. Cause they were passing a joint around here. And I was like, nah, I'm all set. I don't smoke. I'm good. And he's like, oh, that'll knock you out. And I was like, really? And it was late at night. It was like maybe about 11 o'clock. Most of the people had left, it was kind of end of the evening. I said, all right, what the hell? And then I woke up like at 3 a.m, drooling on myself going, whoa, what was that? And then everyone was gone. And, like, whoa, let's go to bed. I went to bed, woke up the next day at like noon. I was like, I just slept for like 13 hours. I feel great. There's no hangover. I'm like, what was that? I want more of that. And so you never forget your first. That was Gorilla Glue number 4. And it punched me in the face, put me out. And that was probably the best. But right now I'm smoking my own. It's gummy bears. And it comes in just shy under 26% when I ran the test.
Nice. Very, very well done.
Yeah,
GG number 4 is one of those classic strains. I hear there's a GG number 5 in the West that people, new is always new. But I actually have a gram of that to the side of me right now in a live butter form. What a great intro, especially to the rest and recovery that cannabis gives. The
Absolutely.
Kind of sleep we all pray for, even at this
Absolutely.
age.
Absolutely.
Right?
And And that's how I started smoking. It wasn't recreational. It was medicinal. It was for insomnia. And so then I had the old school wooden dugout with a little one hitter bat, you know, and I'd
push it in, right?
What's that? I want more of that, you know? And, so I got myself a dugout and a one hitter, and I would just, it would just be literally a hit or two at night for bed. That was it. And I did that for years and years and years and years. And that's kind of formed my habits. Like today, like I haven't smoked, I don't smoke during the day, but tonight I will. That's my reward for, at the end of the day, I come home and I just plop down on the couch. And for me, it's my wind down, unplug and get some good sleep.
That's incredible. You know, I was lucky enough, like about a week ago, I got to talk, to Ricky Williams, the Heisman Trophy winner football player on here. And he mentioned, of course, he's got a big and well-known history with cannabis, in his football career. He said, recovery was everything. You know, he got drug tested so many times in the same way that you found its great utility. It was after everything's done, it gets to kind of bring you back to zero. I thought, yeah, it's like a Lazarus man every night.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
So, thinking, especially actually, I was up in Connecticut recently for their recreational launch they just did, at the beginning of the year. And I know, of course, food is always regional. So is there any Massachusetts style munchies that you go for specifically, or if not that, then in general, just what's your go-to?
You know, I got to tell you something. It's really funny. I'm in Massachusetts now. I live in Milford. Green Goddess Supply is 5 minutes away, in an office here. But I actually was born and raised in Rhode Island, which is only 20 minutes away. I mean, I grew up in a border town, you know, so we were always back and forth between, you know, I have cousins and aunts and uncles who are in Massachusetts, somewhere in Rhode Island. We're right on straddling the border. So now I'm about 20 minutes north into Massachusetts, but I'm actually a Rhode Island guy. And one of the things when I moved here that I realized is that Rhode Island's a big foodie place, and it's just amazing food. And I moved into, and I'm not saying that there isn't, you know, if you can go into Boston, you go into, you know, but that's like, you know, 45 minutes away from where I am. And, you know, that like right where I am around here, I feel like it's a food desert. The food is just not that great. I'm spoiled because down in Rhode Island, the southern half is Italian. The northern half is French Canadian. And both those ethnic, they're all cooks, you know, just history.
Proud cooks too. Yeah.
Yeah. My whole family is, you know, and and then down in like Providence in Rhode Island, Providence, Federal Hill, the Italian food, it's to die for. And we have Johnson Wales Culinary College there. So then all these people graduate locally. And we have all these chefs. We just have so much amazing food. And it's, you know, specialty stuff. Like if I want to, there's a little place in Woonsocket you could go to. It's called K's for a steak sandwich. I don't care. Like people from Philly, I'm sorry. I don't, you know, it is what it is, but I don't want to hear about your Philly cheesesteak. Been there, done that. Go to K's in Woonsocket if you want a steak sandwich done right. So they're like all these places you can go for different things. I love food. I'd have to say my number one munchy thing is, pizza. I love pizza.
And I'm actually a Philly guy, and I take no offense from your comment, because although I do love a trash Philly cheesesteak as they are, I mean, it's street food and it's concept for the most part. One of the best steaks I've ever had, is actually in a little podunk town called Sellersville, PA, probably an hour and a half out of Philly, depending on how you get there. And it's because it's closer to the farm. So naturally, if the meat's better and fresher, everything goes up. They get their rolls from the city, and it's an experience I would challenge any best of. Where it's
local fresh baked rolls, and what they do is they're actual Delmonico steaks, thinly sliced.
Oh yeah,
so it's not the shaved size. It's like real. It's just they're amazing. It's to die for.
That's awesome. They usually say Connecticut's best pizza, right? That's the going myth that I hear all the time.
That's I don't know that. I don't spend enough time in Connecticut myself that I can neither disavow or support that. I don't really have an opinion on that. But I do love, I actually, you know what I love? I love a New York, like New York City Sicilian. I love the Sicilian, a real actual Sicilian pizza.
Right on, right on. It's one of the things that when I was up there traveling a bunch for work, everybody's making their pizza recommendations. And I was like, guys, I'm from pretty Italian. Like there's pizza shops every corner. They're all good. So I had some slices up there. I was like, they're also good. But, you know, temperature wise, I was like, it's edible, like good edible. You know, like I can't really figure out the difference on that. Well, going down to the next question on the high five, bringing the internet into view a little bit. Have you in your time ever bought weed through the internet before things were legal? Did you ever get to use the dark web or the
No, I
weird
never did
message
that.
board days?
No, I never did that. I've done a lot of crazy things, but that was not one of them. Because actually, I wasn't really into weed until about maybe 20, like 2000 something, you know. And I just, you know, I got a guy, you know. So it was I never no, I never did that.
Yeah, I've only so far, even in the industry being as wide and as variable as it is, only one guy, and he was like, he told me, and I was like, that's right, kids used to do that. I wonder who the hell else like took that amazing risk back then, like so
Right.
little guarantee that your money even went anywhere kind of stuff.
Yep.
Still makes me scratch my head. And then for number five, we talked about this a little bit just before we got online, everybody, but what is the best computer OS currently in your opinion? Since you've had so much past with computers, I wonder what your hot take is.
Right. So, you know, what's interesting is I was mentioning earlier that I spent the first 25 years of my adult life as a Microsoft Windows developer. My first business was developing DOS, actually, all the way back to DOS
Good
on
old
a
DOS
five
prompt.
and a quarter DOS on a 5 1/4 inch floppy software. And I spent 25 years as a Windows developer, and there were times, certainly in the beginning, and actually through most of my career, where I absolutely hated the Mac and wish it would just go away. It was annoying. It was a gnat. I mean, it was like at its peak, it was like maybe 4% of the market, where 96% of it was Windows. And then it ebbed out to, you know, once Steve Jobs, you know, got fired and all that stuff, it dropped all the way down to like barely 1%. It was just enough to be annoying. But back then, it really was a crap operating system. It didn't have virtual memory management. It was just the whole thing. It was just people liked it because you know, it was simple to use with the mouse and stuff, and it was graphical, but it was junk. And I believed back then Windows was much better. What happened was when they brought Steve Jobs back, and I'm sure most people know the story, but you know, they went back after everything was crashing. They went back to him. They were like, "All right, we want you back, and we're so sorry. We're so sorry. We're so sorry." And he's like, "Nah, I've already got a gig. I've got another company. I've launched another company. I'm doing stuff. If you want me back, then you have to buy the company. You'll get me back, but through acquisition." And he made them go and spend, I forget what the number, $400 million at the time. And this is like 1990s money, you know? So it was like huge deal. But he made them buy Next Computers. And what he did was he took his Next Step operating system, an object-oriented, you know, Unix, like BSD, based on BSD Unix. Slapped a Mac-like interface so it looked familiar to people, but under the hood, it was a whole radically new operating system. It had nothing other than the name, had really nothing in common with previous versions. And I accidentally kind of got into it when the iPhone came out. I wanted to develop some iPhone apps. And if you wanted to develop iPhone apps, you had to do it on a Mac. The environment was all Mac based. So I was like, oh, you gotta get one of those. Oh, all right, whatever. So I went out and I bought a Mac development machine to plug in to do my Windows development. So I mean my iPhone development. So I had my actual machine, my Windows machine, and then I had like an L-shaped desk, and over here I had the Mac. And as I started getting into it, and the funny thing was, when you do programming on the Mac, all the internal API function calls start with NS underscore. On a Mac today, all the functions, they're all NS underscore, because it's Next Step operating system is what it really is behind the scenes.
Still a callback.
And so I started using it, and it slowly began to dawn on me that how much better that operating system was, and how much better the experience was, and how many things we take for granted. Imagine you walk every day. When you walk in the house, you bang your head against the wall until you bleed a little bit, and then you go about your business. But you do it every day. It's a ritual, and to you, that's normal. And then all of a sudden, someone comes to visit, and they're like, "What the hell are you doing? You don't need to. Like, what are you doing? That's not normal." And you realize, oh, beating my head against the wall till I bleed is not normal. There are all these weird little things that on the Mac it's just done differently, and things like. All the time people spend, think about like your Windows system folder. cleaning your Windows system folder, stray DLLs that would get installed and be left behind, trying to uninstall things, have to delete them from 15 different places, and you always have remnants left. The registry, having to clean and fix your registry. Imagine having everything in the world is in that, all apps, everything's on that, the registry gets corrupt. Everything's dead. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. None of that exists. None of that, that's not normal. I used to have PST files in Outlook that would be too large and they would get corrupted and you have to rebuild your PST files. There's no such thing. That all goes away. So I have to say what happened was I started using the Mac more and more and more. And then I realized you could use like Parallels or VMware and do emulation. And I could just move the whole Windows thing within the Mac and have my Windows thing. Uh-huh. And then I swapped them. And then what happened that then and it was just this slow, like incremental step by step. And then one day I realized I haven't even booted up the Windows VM in like 3 weeks. And I was only booting it up to apply all these updates, automatic updates and all this stuff that it just doesn't exist on the Mac, you know, and all this weird stuff. And I was like, you know what? What am I doing? And I just got away from it. And now it's been 15 years. I'm 100% Mac based. And I look at what goes on Windows and I'm like, yeah, I'm all set with that.
Yeah. I feel like it's, I would say gaming, but I don't really get to express my love of gaming as I used to. Obviously, as you get older, right? Other things become priorital because right. Gaming was like, stay on Microsoft for as long as you can, because that was just the primary release form for it until about that same crux, like early 2000s, mid 2000s, and the tech swapped. So recently I staved off Macs for a while and kept the like PC mentality as long as I could. And then video editing came into my life and I immediately was like, there's no freaking way I'm going Adobe. Like I got to go with FCPX. Like that is built for better every, like just immediately made something which was a headache in the times I'd looked it up into like something which is now smooth. So now I probably have three laptops around and I'm constantly like, where did I save that one file? I'm probably where you were in those days where it's like, I really just need to make the total switch over. Every once in a while, a scabby gaming experience brings you back.
Right. And the thing is, I will say, the thing is that there's a couple big things here. The first is that Apple does have an unfair advantage in that they were a hardware company first, and then they do the operating system. So they only need to make their operating system work with their hardware. Mm-hmm. So it's very different than Windows. Microsoft is building an operating system to run on all the clone, hardware out there, all the different brands of stuff. And so it's got to work with every Sound Blaster card. It's got to work with every, some idiot comes up with some new sound card. It's got to work with that too. You know, it's got to work. So all these device drivers, they're trying to be everything to everybody and everything plus the kitchen sink all built in, 50,000 device drivers and all the stuff. So when you think about speed, efficiency, all those things, Apple just needs to work with their hardware. It's a very limited, it's got to work with these four current models. And they even, just like Microsoft will do, they'll sunset old versions. So it's like they know what it's got to work with and that's it. The other thing is they're not afraid of just ripping off the Band-Aid. Like when Steve Jobs came in and said, everything up to Mac OS 9, gone, whole new operating system, do it right. They reset and do it right. Whereas Microsoft is always like it's carrying the baggage of everything going all the way back to Windows 1.0. You know what I mean? Like the 3.0. Yeah, they just got to keep all that baggage, make everything compatible with everything. And it's just trying to be all things to all people. And so they're in an impossible position. But there was also one by choice. So.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I like that. That was actually that tickled the right parts of all of my my experience with computers. I really do appreciate you going deep on that. I can absolutely enjoy it. But we'll jump into the main interview. We'll bring cannabis into focus because, as you mentioned, Microsoft does a bevy of things, right? They try to be a little bit to all people. And I would say greengoddesssupply.com, when I was able to visit there the first time, I saw what was a smorgasbord. Ideally, it was like a great one-stop feature. I didn't really need to go off-site unless I wanted something, obviously, name-brand customized sort of level. But the focus on home grow, the amazing amount of things. What should people think about when they think of your business and website of Green Goddess Supply? What was your inspiration?
Okay. So absolutely. So we started off as an accessory company.
Okay.
Day one. Okay. So when I say excess, consumption and things like the grinder, really nice. We're all about quality. I could geek out on the holes and all, the size of the holes and all the stuff to, all grinders are not the same. What it's made of, how we do it, it's not plated. This is not painted. It's not going to flake off. It's anodized aluminum. The size of the holes, like I see, usually have too many teeth and they're ground, they're too close together and the holes are too small. There's not enough. So when you're grinding it up, you're just kind of clogging up the deck here at the grinding deck instead of having it fall through. So all these little, you know, the engineering and the threads and all that stuff, but basically a nice high quality product. We have our sifter boxes. I don't know if you see, I get a little clear here.
That's looking good from there, yeah.
Keef sifter boxes. So you grind up your weed, you put it in the top. It's got a screen here. So it's your storage box. It's your stash box. But also, either just passively, just by picking it up and moving it and doing whatever, or if you want to sit there and actually shake, you end up getting keef in the bottom. You get your keef down there. And this is what I have on my coffee table. So for me, my weed's right here. It's not in a jar that you can see or that looks dirty or also is not very discreet. If, you know, grandma comes over to visit unexpectedly and I haven't cleaned up yet or whatever, and she's unapproving of my weed or whatever, it doesn't matter. This is just sitting out on my coffee table. And it's nice, gorgeous satin finish product. So we were out. What I noticed, and when I first launched Green Goddess, I noticed that if I walked into a head shop, they'd have all these different products out there, but everything was generic imports, unbranded generic imports. Or if there was a particular brand, these guys did a really nice rolling tray, but that's all they did. These guys, like No Goo, did the little dab jars, you know, and they had nice silicone dab jars, but that's all they did. You know, they were like one-offs, kind of like the one-hit wonder bands of the 80s. You know, they're like just like one-hit one-offs. So if you like something, they do a really good job, but now you want, you know, they have a great rolling tray, but now you want a grinder. You just don't know where to go. Like, I don't know. Then you're floating around. And I saw the need for a good quality brand that, and that's what we're doing with Green Goddess Supply, that if you like our grinder and you know, like, wow, these guys have a really nice high-end, good quality, that doesn't mean expensive, but quality, a good quality grinder. Now, and I'm used to that. Now I'm going and I'm looking for a rolling tray, and you want a nice, you know, gorgeous bamboo rolling tray. Green Goddess has rolling trays. Okay. You make that assumption, that connection between, the brand and the quality of the products. So we're trying to create a curated line of really nice, high quality products. We've come up with a lot of originals.
That's a phenomenal thing. Now
they're in different sizes. You can put your pre-rolls in them. We have different sizes pre-rolls, standard paper joints, and then longer ones for the king size joints. There's a special 421. So we have this array. We have metal pipes, we have bangers, we have glass, we've got the bong, the water pipes.
Beautiful looking piece too.
It's gorgeous.
Nice etching on the bottom and everything.
Yep, etching there, around there, up the neck. I have the blur feature on, so you don't have to see my clutter behind me. But you see the glass pieces. So the goal was to create like a brand extension, it's called, but you know, a product line of high quality products that even our glass. We have a whole huge selection of glass, and they're all super thick, heady glass. They're fumed. This one's gold fumed. There'll be gold, nickel, silver fumed. So the color changers and so forth. They're all super, super thick at really great price points. Like this is a $24 pipe.
Yeah, it's a great price. That's like a $45 pipe most places.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's good quality price points, but good quality products. And that's what we started. And then, you know, I was a software geek, right, for all those years. So going back to 1993, I've been working with Vincent in the software industry. And somewhere around 2017, 2018, that time frame, he had reached out to me and wanted to know if I did a post on Facebook about Green Goddess. And he knew me as the computer guy, right? You know, the software guy. We had done hundreds and hundreds of titles together. We did games, screensavers, children's like interactive storybooks, read to me storybooks and stuff, on all kinds of like TV and movie stuff. So we did like Batman and Robin, Little Rascals, Free Willy, Land Before Time. And so we did the Terminator 2 screensaver. We've done all kinds of stuff. Saturday Night Live, I Love Lucy. We did hundreds of titles together over many, 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 many years, over like 20 years. Then we did iPhone apps together. We did about 30 or 40 iPhone apps together when the iPhone came out. So then in 2018, he reached out to me and he says, "Hey, I saw you posted something about Green Goddess. Like, you know, the way you were phrased it or whatever. It's like, you know, those guys, like, right?" He says, I'm like, "Yeah." He goes, "How well do you know them?" I'm like, "Really well." I'm like, "Well, why?" And he's like, "Could you introduce me? Like, I bet you that could be arranged." And I'm like, "Why?" And he's like, "Well, you know, I invented this this grow box." Mm-hmm. Like, "What? You did? Like, you grow weed?" He goes, "Well," and here, and then this was the revelation.
Right.
We're both in the software industry, but we don't talk about it. This was 2017, 2018, you know, time frame. It's like, you don't talk, historically, you don't talk about this. It's all under radar, you know, whatever. He goes, "Yeah, actually, I'm in software because I need to earn a living. And this is what I do for a living." He says, "But way back in the 70s, he goes, "I actually went to college for botany. I studied botany, plant morphology." He goes, he's a biologist, plant biologist. Yeah. And there was not really much, like, he wasn't making a career out of it or whatever. And anyway, long story short, ended up from the music industry, got into software and all the stuff. And anyway, had the day job, right? Because mm-hmm. I've been growing since the 70s. And he does, I do all kinds under radar, but he says, he was like, you know, back in the old days, you know, the master grower, it's kind of a phrase right. These days, but back in the day. And he did a lot of consulting with big grows. They would have problems, issues, whatever. They'd call him in and help solve their problems. And, you know, they had spider mites or this or that or whatever, or, you know, powdery mildew, this, that. Yeah. And he would help them figure out how to build their grow facilities to not have these issues and all that stuff. And he was into this whole thing and said that he had friends and family would say, you know, "Oh, you grow all these beautiful plants," and you'd have all the stuff going, you know, and they'd say, "Can you teach me how to grow? I just want to grow one for myself." And to be like, "Where do I even start?" And that was where he came up with the concept, which is today the Armoire. It wasn't called that back then, you know. But what he came up with is he built this home grow system, and he's like, "I want to bring this to market, and I'm looking, but I don't want to start from scratch, and I wanted to partner up with someone to bring this to market. I was hoping you could introduce me." I'm like, "All right, well, consider yourself introduced. You know, I am Green God." Mm-hmm. She's like, "What?" And I'm like, "Yes." So we went into not holding. I told him what I was doing, and what I was like, "No kidding." So we partnered up, and we ended up put a patent together. It got granted. It is patented.
Oh, that's cool.
And we brought it to market, and it's been a labor of love. And so what we did was kind of like Apple started off. It was Apple computers, and then they came out with the MP3 player, the iPod, right? Mm-hmm. And then the iPod turned into the iPhone. And then now today, if you said Apple, like word association, you know, Apple, iPhone, you're not even thinking Mac. You're like, Apple is iPhone. And like, you know, whatever it is, I don't know, 60, 70% of all their revenue is derived from the iPhone, you know? And the other 30% is basically services related to the iPhone, the iTunes music and all the other services and all the other stuff. You know? And of course they still sell computers and stuff, but it's, you know, this much of the pie, right? Think Apple, you think iPhone. And what's happened is the iPhone, the iPod first, starting with the iPod and then into the iPhone, Apple computers now, their market share is growing as desktop. Now you see Mac and laptops and the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro
and all that stuff, right?
Everywhere. You see them everywhere. You sit down in an airport and their Mac machine, everyone's got them in their laptops and they're working on, you know, waiting for their flights and stuff. You just see them everywhere, right? Market share is going through the roof, and it's through that sort of halo effect of people have the iPhone, then they get the Macs, and it all works together, and they create this whole seamless environment, and then they've got the iTunes, and now they've got the Apple TV, and then they're doing the Siri HomeKit, and just the whole thing. It's a whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And it sells more computers and all that stuff. That kind of concept is what we're doing with the Armoire. It's now we are over the years, we've really gone all in on this, and our whole identity, we're all about empowering. Our mission as a company is to empower everybody and anybody who wants to be able to grow their own at home quickly, easily, discreetly, and inexpensively. Okay. That what we've done is we've created a home grow system that's super simple. Water it once a day. You got this. Okay. And by creating and empowering people to do it themselves, now they're growing it. Then it's like, okay, well, now how are you grinding it? How are you storing it? How are you rolling it? How are you smoking it, consuming it, and storing it, you know, sifter boxes. And so now it starts with, you know, I've grown my own, and then all the other accessories and stuff now to store it, consume it, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So that's kind of our vision. But it all starts with, we're empowering people to be able to grow their own. One of the key things that people don't realize is that if you think about California, mm-hmm. and especially like if you don't live in California, like I'm out in the Boston area. You said you're like Philly, you're East Coast.
Just north of Philadelphia. Yeah.
There you go. All right. So you probably will make sense. If you're out here and you talk about California, you're like, oh, that's a legal state. Oh, yeah. They can all go to a dispensary, right?
Yeah. No. Oh, yeah. No, the goal is it's exactly where we want to be. You know, everybody loves Cali Buds, the whole culture of it.
60% of the residents of California do not have access to a local dispensary. 60%, more than half the state. The reason is because although they made it state legal, individual towns and counties can opt out of having pot shops there. Just like where I am in Massachusetts is legal. But my town, I live in Milford. Milford said mm-hmm. no to pot shops. They said no to pot shops. Now, we have such density and the towns are all so small and everything else that literally 1 mile up the road, oh, there are pot shops because it's the next town, you know, so it's not really that big of a deal. But like in California, there are entire areas where you could be like 2 hours, 3 hours, like the equivalent of like you're in Boston and like go to New York City to hit a dispensary, yeah. You know? It's just not local. Or like you feel it. You have to go to Boston to get to a dispensary. It's like, yeah, it's not happening. But when they make it state legal, you can grow at home. So everybody can grow their own if they want to. But you don't necessarily have access to a dispensary.
Yeah, that's something that, especially because PA is still only medical, big state, it's over 60 dispensaries spread, you know, wouldn't say exactly even, but contrasted by the cities. And it's something that I think a lot of folks still have a lot of back and forth about concerning at this stage. It's like what companies support it versus which companies don't, because you can always imagine some bean counters like, no, home grow is going to eat our business. I'm like, brother, I cook burgers at home. McDonald's doesn't lose a dollar on me, I'm sure. It's just the idea that there's not enough for everyone when there's like so much more than we ever need for everyone.
That's a huge, huge myth and misconception. And we hear it too, because like we've gone out looking for investors and partners and stuff. I want to partner up with folks. And like, so dispensary owners, we were like, hey, let's partner up. Like, you know, and some of them get it. And most of them don't. They see it as home grows competition, you know. And I'm like, dude, there's already like, do you know how much home grows out there? Let me put it this way. I know I have the stats in the surveys. All right. So like, you know, we have access to New Frontiers data and their logins and all their reports and all their stuff. Home grow. They did a report recently, an exhaustive study on all this. And I'm quoting these numbers I may be slightly inaccurate, but for a ballpark, I'm
right in the realm of possibilities, right?
It's all pretty close. Like I might be off one, you know, digit or something, but like the legal market, the total legal market right now in the US is like $19 billion. And it's broken down into, I think it's like, this is the part that's fine. I forget how it's broken down, but it's like 12 of it is rec and 7 is medicinal, you know, and it adds up to like $19 billion in 2022, this last year, $19 yeah. billion dollars of weed. And then they studied how much home grow has produced. And if it was sold at national, at, you know, when they do the math and everything else, like if that had been sold, it's the equivalent of $14 billion worth of home grow. Okay. So it's more than rec. Adult recreational, I think, was 12 and home grow is 14. Home grow produces more than adult rec. But then when you add the medicinal, you know, the medical only.
It starts to, champion the number up.
But 19 versus 14, I mean, it's like, it's incredible. And then the illicit market, the black market, was like 20-something, 24 or 20.
Yeah, like, I feel like I saw 25 on that at one point. Yeah, which is
so 24, 25 or something, which is huge. So my point with all this is that, like, for a dispensary that's saying not everybody's going to want to grow at home, not everybody's going to want it, not everybody, most people, you know, that's fine. There are people that are going to want to get their products at dispensary. And even if you are home grow, you still go into a dispensary. Like, if I want rosin, I'm not sitting there personally. I grow my flower, I pack a bowl, and I do my thing. I'm not going to start processing and doing all this, you know, like if I want to do dabs, I'm going to go to get that. Sometimes I'll have a party, I'll have something, and I want some pre-rolls. I'll just go pick them up. Like, I'm not going to sit there and start, like, I'm not a roller, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I just pack a bowl all of the day. I'm going to start sitting there and rolling a bunch. I'll just go pick them up at the dispensary. And the smart dispensary, I see it out west, like in Colorado and stuff. They're selling seeds because they know that people are doing home grow. Get them to come back in, like, come in for the seeds, come in for the genetics, you know, because seeds are consumables, and keep them coming back in. And so the smart people, and I see dispensaries all the time, they're not selling the accessories and stuff. They're like, they're just focused on weed. And they're losing out. Like, the smart ones that get it, they have accessories. They don't want to turn into a head shop and have 50,000 things, but they have a decent selection of the most common stuff. And they're selling seeds. Embrace that market. You know, I look at this one dispensary when I was talking to, and I was like, dude, you're burying your head in the sand. You're lying to yourself and believing it. You think that, like, oh, squash home grow. Like, no, it's already here. They're already doing it. Do you notice? You're like, oh, let's stop this. It's not like some new phenomenon that's going to come on. Look at all the hydro stores everywhere. There's $14 billion worth of weed already being grown. Okay. But it's to your point. I say it all the time. Just because McDonald's opened doesn't mean Stop and Shop or Price Chopper or whatever your local grocery store. You know, the grocery store is not going out of – Whole Foods. They're not going out of business because of McDonald's opened, right, or vice versa. You know, Whole Foods opened. Oh, McDonald's is going to – no.
Oh, no.
Sometimes you eat out. Sometimes you go grocery shopping. You cook at home. Home garden, personal gardens. You're trying to get Home Depot and to stop selling Scotts Miracle-Gro, stop selling, you know, seeds for cucumbers and stuff. Just because I grow a few cucumbers, trust me, I'm still going to the grocery store. You know, I might supplement with some of my own or whatever, but, you know, there's plenty of market share for everyone. So I don't see them as directly competitive at all.
Yeah, there's a desperation, I think, to that attitude where
it's greed. It's corporate greed, and I call them out.
It's like, I don't know if I'm gonna have this much money tomorrow. And there's been a rhythm to that, I guess. Maybe I've noticed, I'll mention, if not tangentially, then relative to it. It seems that a lot of times, because again, every market's somewhat unpredictable, but for some reason people really seem to experience a lot of fear in that potential loss instead of driving new products and new innovation. And it seems to be something, especially in this age of information, where, you know, I don't know what part of America necessarily you'd want to call it as the best part, but there seemed to be a little bit more just creativity. Like, let's make a product and sell it. Where now it's more like, let's repackage or sell attention. And as much as I know that attention is a potent thing and was always a part of business, it seems more focal. If somebody gets the attention and the product sucks, they're like, yeah, but I got the attention, so I've won. It blows my mind. I like, of course, the model that you are prescribing to, which is, let me make something which actually benefits the market, because that innovation creates new opportunities. So when there's stagnation, it isn't just the idea of opportunism only. It's actually the idea of innovating in those opportunities. Like, oh, there's no more bowls to sell. Let me think of what's next, instead of, well, I guess we're just going to charge up for these and not think about the next step to it.
Right. And it's also, you know, there, like I was saying, there's markets. You know, what I say back to, you know, some of these folks is they're saying, no, I want to, you know, like the dispensary owners, like, I want to squash home grow because it's competitive. And it's like, no, it's not. What you're missing out on is, what about that? That's already going on. And there's a piece of the market. So let's say you want to plop down. Now, I don't know if it's changed over the last couple of months, but there was a point where Fresno, like all interior, Bakersfield, Fresno, there's no dispensaries within hours. And that may have changed recently. I don't know. But I know, like, as of whatever, 6 months ago, whatever. Like, so let's say, you know, there's a huge swath in California where there's just no dispensaries. So why not get a piece of the home grow market and get a piece of that market? Because, all right, you have dispensaries. You can't put one there anyway. They won't let you.
Dragging their feet. That's what we experienced, especially with Jersey and alcohol. There's a lot of towns on the shore, and they're dry towns because of the same thing. They're like, we just don't want to invite that. I understand. Not necessarily the best news I've ever heard, but if you leave it down to the county level, you're going to have those hot spots and those dry spots, especially ripe for innovations.
Right. And you're going to have, you know, folks who older, like, you know, seniors who maybe don't drive anymore or just don't want to. They pick and choose, but they, you know, start as you get older, you start having vision issues and this and that. And yeah, I can't, you know, night driving and all that kind of stuff. And so it's like, I just want to grow my own. Or let's say you're just like my mother doesn't drive. My father's passed away. My mother doesn't drive. So it's like, okay, well, if she needs it for medicinal purposes and wants to grow it, why can't she just grow one plant at home herself, do her thing? She doesn't want to have to like drive out. She can't drive to a dispensary. So now she would be dependent upon someone. But you know, with home grow, we're empowering people to be able to take it into their own hands and do what they need to do and do what they want to do.
Yeah. That reminds me, my mom's also at an age where, you know, she's not the most physical person anymore. She had a dog that she had to kind of mend with because it's like, this dog will yank me down the road and drag me. It's not good for a woman over 70, but she has like four amazing Scotch bonnet pepper plants in her kitchen and a scorpion plant that's doing pretty well. And it's like, this is exactly what we recommend to people in their old, like, keep your cognition, keep your hobbies. It sounds like exactly amazing product that could fill, especially that area, beyond even what it obviously does to just people who are interested in home grow. Cause I can say I'm grow stupid. So hearing there's a system that can get you most of the way there, you could probably throw autos in there and have an easier time, means great. That means I can get to that first step of confidence without feeling like I've spent like $1,000 on lighting and not understanding things, because I think it's a high gate of entry for a lot of folks who are unfamiliar.
Right. And that's where we've leveled the playing field. What we have done, our approach is not to sell like the way traditional, you know, like hydroponic, traditional grow equipment is sold. Like you go into a hydro store, it's sold like Home Depot sells tools. Okay. You can go into a Home Depot and you can buy all kinds of saws and sawzalls and hammers and whatever, and all kinds of fancy tools and stuff, but you're on your own. They figure you know what to do with it, or you're going to figure that out. Like, you know, like they're not there to teach you how to build, right? Just like cars, you go into Toyota and you buy a car, like, great, here you go. And they'll sell you a car, but they're not going to teach you how to drive. Okay. You know, you're on your own to figure that out. And that's how grow equipment has traditionally been sold. And so it's sold to what I refer to, you know, I'm a little older, right? So what I refer to as the MacGyver types, right? You know, I'm going to take a paperclip, a rubber band, and a pencil and make a nuclear bomb out of it, you know? MacGyver, we could just like figure out, you know, see, MacGyver, it became a verb. I'm going to MacGyver something here. well, like grow tents like that, roll up the sleeves and figure it out. And it's really complicated. Like I was a perfect example of this when I started talking to Vincent. I always thought like growing my own would be really badass. I thought that'd be really cool. Like, that'd be really cool. However,
a lot of people want to make their own strain. That's kind of a thing that I hear a lot too, right?
Yep. But I was absolutely not willing to do it. I wasn't willing to do it. I thought it would be, it's too complicated, too time consuming, too expensive. Like, it's just all the, you know, too much magnesium, not enough nitrogen, CalMag, what's the pH of the water, pH of the soil, what's your runoff, test this, what's your humidity, VPD, you know, it just complicated.
Predatory mites, I heard once, and I was like, holy crap, predatory mites, like, that's a whole category of science I'm not as aware of.
Oh, and nematodes.
Throwing out Latin terms like it's the hottest thing.
it's just all this stuff, right? Yeah. What's your IPM? What? Integrated pest management protocols. You know, all this stuff. Like, it's insane, right? That's the MacGyver stuff. Like for those early adopters, people who love that stuff, great. That's great. That's not me. All right. I want, like, I don't know how my car works. I just get in and I turn the key, stick a key in, turn it, and I just get from point A to point B. It just works. It's just it's an appliance. It gets just like, I don't know how the microwave, I don't know nanometers and X-ray waves and gamma wave. I don't know any of that shit. I don't care. I stick in a plate of food. I close the door. I push the button for 30 seconds. I come out. Oh, look, it's hot. Okay. That's what we're doing with the armoire. Whereas stuff is sold like, here, you're on your own. For us with the armoire, and now we have grow tents that have now followed up. They're bigger and they're tents that work in the same system. But it started with the armoire where we said, look, what's nice about the armoire is it looks like furniture. It's super discreet and it's small. You can put it in your living room, home office, spare bedroom, your bedroom, whatever. It looks like furniture. It's totally discreet. It's not some big tent. Like, because that was back in the day. It was like, How the hell am I putting a tent? You know, I have two little kids, and it's not even
big ass purple tent, floor to ceiling.
Yeah, where am I sticking a tent? And it's smell. My house is gonna reek like weed and all that stuff. And it's just too complicated. I didn't care enough about doing all that, right? So I wasn't willing to do what it would take. But the armoire, it looks like furniture. You can stick it literally in any room. If you're in a walk-up apartment, you're in a 900 square foot inner city, like you're in New York, you're in Boston or whatever, and you got a small apartment. Like, you don't have a basement or an attic to stick a tent, but you can put this in the corner. You just take an armoire and stick it in the corner. And it looks like furniture. So a grandma, unapproving grandma comes over, she doesn't even have to know what it is. It just looks like a cute cabinet in the corner. That's the end. I've had people come into my house. They don't even know what it is. I don't say nothing. They leave. They have no idea what it was. And so that was the first thing, is discretion. But really, when we sell it, the hardware is really for other people. Like, you go to a hydro store, the hardware is what you're getting. For us, that's just a third of the equation. The second third is, it's our own grow protocol that we've greatly simplified the protocol. Remember at the beginning, I was saying Apple has an unfair advantage because they build the hardware, so they only need to make their operating system work with their hardware.
Only for that application and integration, yeah.
We've created our own protocol that works with our box, because our box, we already know how many, you know, cubic feet of air we have to move around, what the fans are, everything is built, everything comes together, it's a full complete kit. And we've created our own protocol where we know, because we know all the variables, we were able to eliminate a whole bunch of stuff and say, look, just do this, water it once a day, you're pretty good. There's stress training at about week three. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it, but if you want it, but for best results, you do the stress training. We create our own, we call it the ring of fire approach. Vincent invented this, a ring of fire approach to LST, low stress training. Yeah. And you can get anywhere from 50 to 100% more yield, like anywhere from half to double more yield out of a plant. Okay, so where people are growing, like let's say an auto, they do like a 60-day auto and they get an ounce or two. We're getting like 4, 5, 6, sometimes up to 8 ounces, you know, in like 60 days or so out of this plant by doing these LST techniques and stuff. And the thing is, so we've got the hardware, we've got our own protocol that's very simplified. Okay, so you don't have to worry about all this crazy stuff. Water it once a day, like treat it like a house plant. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is, we have our one-to-one concierge service. So when you get to that, you want to do LST and you want to get higher yields, we'll get on a Zoom call like this, one-to-one, and we'll say, okay, now put this here, put that there. No, and we can see your plant, you know, we'll say, we'll have you set up and we'll do a Zoom call. And we're like, no, move that over, put that here. And we will teach you how to do it. Like, oh, once you've done it once, you get it. Oh, I see. Okay. And then if you have problems, you're at week six and all of a sudden it's yellowing and this is happening, that's happening. And you can call up and be like, hey, I'm having an issue with my plant. All right, well, let's check it out. Let's see. We have that one-to-one consulting service.
Tech support. It's phenomenal.
Grow tech support, right. like people don't do that. Like, you buy tents, you're on your own. Like, but with ours, with the armoire, it came with that. We gave 90 days, which was enough to get through your whole first grow. You got 90 days free. You could buy extended if you wanted to be our friends and talk to us forever. We're more than happy to do that for extended. But every single armoire gets 90 days. We'll get you through your whole entire first grow, walk you through it, hold your hand, get you through it. And then people are like, oh, okay, I get it, and go from there. And then with the tents, we made it because you're growing more plants. It's a bigger system and there's more going on. We give you a full year of concierge service with the tents. Tent system, it's a very high quality. Our tents, standard in the industry is usually 600D. That's the thickness. And sometimes you get like 1200D. We got a 2000D. So it's like kind of like thread count, if you think about like sheets. Yeah. So it's a much denser, thicker material, super high quality product, big, nice, thick tent poles and everything. And it comes with all of our own, all the internal guts are the same guts that we use in the armoire. So it's got the same external fan with the controller. It's got the same light, our own proprietary unicorn light, we call it, that we developed because it's the unicorn of grow lights, because we couldn't find exactly what we needed on the market. So we designed our own. And with our tent, we give you two of them. We have a 4x2 tent. We give you two of them. So you can have, each plant can have its own light.
All right. On like zone control.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of just mounting one at the top and whatever, you know, we give you two quality lights and they have knobs on them that you can dial instead of just on off bloom switches or whatever. We have light dials that you can dial it in, and we give you two lights. So we sell it as a two plant system. You could put three or four in it, but we bill it as a two plant system. Each one independently, each half gets its own light. So you can have different heights, different, you know, different settings. You have two different genetics. You can have different settings and so forth with them.
That's great. And what of like armoire for the single plant? And then you obviously can easily expand because you'd be familiar with the hardware with the next upgrade. So it's a very
We have a bunch of customers that have the armoires that bought a second one. We have people who have the armoire that bought the tents and now they have armoires and tents.
Yeah.
And they'll, and go like once they get comfortable with it, but now it's all the same system, the same lights, the same protocol and whatever. Now they're like, oh, I'm comfortable with this. Now let's do it in an expanded in a tent and it's more expanded because I have the room for that, you know?
That's incredible. So it's obvious that your mind is very active and you see a lot of opportunity. I think where other people falter a bit in being able to kind of put together patterns and see new things. Now I've seen you refer to it before as like a marketing mindset. And it seems almost, I mean, I might be assuming here, but I bet I can throw like four words at you and you'd probably be like, there's a way that we can make this work into something. What are some of the advantages or how do you feel that you've been able to kind of develop towards that kind of mentality? I think a lot of people will otherwise feel like they're probably thinner in their creative version of it. But I mean, given you went from obviously software and doing it a lot in that market into cannabis, two markets I'd say in our time that in my lifetime, being a child of 84, pretty much the only two booms I've seen was the internet coming to fruition. And then, of course, you know, right as I was getting out of high school, about 2002, it was crashing and sort of like changing its colors a little bit and making what it is now. And now cannabis, the new green rush. I guess talk a little bit about maybe how that all plays into the marketing mindset, because it's a wide berth of success between the two.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is you brought up, it's funny that you mentioned that you talk about the tech and so forth. Because that's one of the things that drew me to this industry. I will admit that initially, very initially, I was in the tech space and I kind of tripped into the whole what became Green Goddess, but saw the opportunity and saw the needs in the marketplace and all that and latched on and went with it. And what really, really attracted me to this space was that it was a new emerging industry, and I just had shades of late 80s, early 90s tech industry. So there were parallels there that back in those days, you had people, making shit up as they go, right? You had people pioneering and developing all this stuff. I mean, there was a time when Bill Gates, I mean, if you've read the biographies and all that, there were times where Bill Gates originally was down in New Mexico, sleeping at the office under his desk on the verge of bankruptcy. And then, you know, right place, right time with IBM and blah, 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 and then moved to Seattle and then it just took off. And then they pioneered the whole industry. And like, there was no such thing as, you know, Windows and whatever, and all this pioneering. And then you had, you know, Michael Dell building PCs out of his dorm room at college, you know, and it took off and he turned into, hey, wait a minute, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit and let's turn this into a business, you know. And you had all this innovation and all this stuff going on. It was all new and it was like the Wild West.
Yeah. And the term I use for it.
and so that's that was really attractive and exciting to me. It was all new. It was learning. I was like a sponge learning all the stuff and figuring out and being part of that, even if it's just in a small little way, being part of that innovation. Back in the software days, you know, screensavers were a niche. Okay. And a lot of people don't even think about them. You know, it was a little niche. But my company was the 800-pound gorilla in that niche. Okay, we were the big fish in a little pond, we dominated that niche. Like, so there was like 96% of all the screensavers.
Yeah, that's what I read. Yeah, incredible numbers, man.
Yeah. Even if they were like white labeled and done for other people, but people coming to us, we were doing screensavers for Folgers Coffee. We did them for Walmart. If you went to a Walmart store and the computer screens, you know, they were having some problems back in the original days. Screensavers really were to save your screen, and they had screen burning. They were ruining all the monitors.
Yeah,
the
I was gonna say burning as hell.
so we did them for chains like CVS was using them. I'll never forget the first big site license check that I got was from the Canadian Royal Mounted Police, the government, the RCMP. Bought a license to put the screensavers on all their computers in Canada. We had Walmart. If you walked into a Walmart store and you saw the Walmart logo bounce around, we actually did that for them. We did stuff for the New York Knicks, the San Diego Chargers. We did stuff for Folgers Coffee. We did multiple projects for Bacardi, for Mobil Oil, all these guys, right? And then tons and tons of retail stuff. And then when the internet came along, it was internet downloadable stuff. And but we, our shop, we were the first people to ever do character animation. We did the Terminator 2 screensaver with Arnold Schwarzenegger walking around. Yeah. We're the first ones to do interactive desktop stuff. He was blowing holes in the desktop and your actual screen being, you know, we're the first people to do sound in screensavers. We're the first people to do interactive screensavers that turn into game mode and you could play the game. We, you know, on and on and on and on. We're just innovating.
I remember these very well. This was like primary things that I was downloading and being exposed to. Like, I remember the early days. It's probably like, you know, late grade school of when you were like, wow, this screensaver actually like shoots you and you can see the screen is deteriorating and there'd be a funny comment with it. Like it was clear as day and you would spend time. I mean, although it's probably turned into ringtone people eventually, like when cell phones came out and then nowadays, who knows what they're looking at, freemium gaming, but it was something to be admired. You literally did spend time being like, I want that screensaver. Of course, we try to probably pirate everything we could back then, but it was still, you know, back in the days of shareware.
Back in the days of shareware and shareware, nobody knew what it was. It was the days of Microsoft. If you wanted Microsoft Word, you had to go to Radio Shack and buy it off the shelf for $500 in a box and hope it did what you wanted. You know,
a box that was like bigger than your fridge for some reason.
Big, huge box. And it was $500 for Microsoft Word. And you had to just assume that it's going to do what you want. And it's a shrink wrap license. So once you get home, if it doesn't do what you want, oh, well, you can't return it. And so we pioneered, as an industry, the try before you buy shareware model. And back in the day, you know, I got involved with the Association of Shareware Professionals. I became chairman of the board of the ASP, the Association of Shareware Professionals. We ran shareware industry conferences, and did all that stuff. And I was heavily involved in all of that stuff. And it is funny because we eventually got to the point we were running these shareware conferences and stuff for developers and all that. And I'll never forget one day, my buddy, Rob Rosenberger, I held a conference in Rhode Island because I was in Rhode Island. I was running the conference. And so I brought the conference to Rhode Island. And we did it 2 years in a row, did it in 94, 95. I think it was in 1995. He got up there and he basically, I had him do a keynote address for the, at the awards banquet on whatever the Saturday night or whatever it was. And he got up there and he said, "We won." I'll never forget that. We declared, we won, because now everybody does the try before you buy. We don't call it shareware, but every software is now, you can download a trial on the internet.
Yeah,
Microsoft Word, you can buy, download a free trial. And once Microsoft was doing it, everyone was doing it, whether they actually called it shareware or not, but they were all doing a downloadable trial version and all. And it's like, we changed the whole industry. The industry now works that way, you know? And that was all exciting to be part of that and innovating those things and doing all that. And then what happens, like normally happens, is eventually the industry matures and then it's all run by Wall Street. And, you know, Michael Dell is just, you know, in a suit and, you know, on Wall, you know, dealing with Wall Street people all day long, Bill Gates, you know, the Gates Foundation and all this stuff. And, you know,
it's
the
whole shareholders run it all at that point.
Shareholders. And I'm not saying there's no innovation, but it just becomes matured. You get lots more people, lots more competition and a lot more, you know, and it changes in the industry. And it's like, okay. And it's like, you know, and it's like, it just feels like incrementalism after that. And it gets, you know, to me, it was like, okay, you know, back in the heyday, back in those glory days, but now it's just kind of like business as usual. And the cannabis industry is like, all of a sudden it was like shades of 1990 all over again. It's the Wild West. It's these brands are emerging, people trying to figure this stuff out. And I will say, this is the hardest, working in this industry is the hardest thing I've ever done. Absolutely the hardest thing I've ever done.
Oh, really?
I'm not even selling weed or anything. We just sell accessories. None of this is regulated. It's just metal. It's blocks of wood. It's storage boxes, not regulated. Okay. I'm not selling any cannabis. I'm not a cannabis company. I'm marketing into that consumer, you know, to a cannabis consumer to use my products and stuff. But even then, we have banking issues. You have merchant account issues. Like we pay through the nose. We pay like five times more for our merchant accounts on percentages than like, if I had a restaurant, I always say it all the time. If I had a restaurant, I wouldn't be coming in every day fearful that, you know, is my credit card processing shut down today? But in my industry, guess what? It's already happened like three times just to me alone. And I'm not even regulated.
In the regulators, it's, I know, since I've worked for a couple brands, they just shut the card. You're like, I literally can't book a flight. The card's dead, you know, and it happens in real time constantly.
Yep. No warning. And like I had one, they called up and they just shut us down. And one time it had nothing to do with us at all. But it was the bank processor, the merchant processor themselves. I'll never forget. It was Evo Payments. I don't care. I'll throw them under the bus. They, Evo Payments, we were using them. They called up one day. They wanted to sell. They wanted to sell the business, like as a business. They were going through an acquisition thing and all that stuff. And they wanted to clean up their books. They wanted to get rid of the high risk section. And because we sold pipes and stuff, we're considered high risk. It's not, but they love to put us in that category and then charge us not the 1.79% merchant fees, but charge you like 6 or 9 or whatever, you know, 5%, you know, anything of 5 to 10%. Like it's like 3, 4, 5 times more than what a restaurant would be doing for, you know, steak sandwiches. They wanted to clean that up and get it off the books. So they're like, yeah, we're just shutting down all these things. And they wanted to clean it up to not have any high risk stuff on their books. They went, so they called me up one day and I'll never forget this. It was a Tuesday. And they just said, hey, you know, we're really sorry, but you know, we're shutting it down. It's not you. There's nothing you can do about it. It's not you. They terminated 3,000 merchants.
Wow.
3,000 merchants. Okay. And they said, we understand you're going to need to get another thing. So we'll give you to the end of the week. Now it can take 2 weeks to a month to get a merchant account. We'll give you to the end. We'll give you till Friday before we shut it down. I'm like, oh, gee, thanks. You give me 3 days of runway that I can get my applications in. I still haven't even heard back yet by the time you shut me down. And we had gaps where all of a sudden now, like, you have an e-commerce store where you can't take credit cards. You can't like, what are you supposed to do now? They send you scrambling. And we went scrambling and we got hooked up with someone else and got up and running. And about 2 months later, I got a call, like a win back call from EVO Payments, called me up like, hey, we saw that you had an account with us. We know, but we're the new owners. And we actually want what happened. I guess they did this because they had multiple suitors and whatever it was. They I don't know all the details behind the scenes, but they divested all of these 3,000 some odd merchants. And then like a few months later, 3 months later, whatever it was, the new owners, they're calling back saying, can we get you back? And I'm like, dude, it's a little late. You totally screwed me over. You know, well, that wasn't us. That was the old, you know, but we want you back. I'm like, do you think I've been sitting around for 3 months with no credit card processing? I went somewhere else. I'm all set. Thanks. Those kinds of things don't happen when you're in software or if you're running a restaurant or whatever. This is the hardest industry to work in. You have banking issues. You can't advertise on Facebook. You can't advertise on Google. You can't have, if you, you know, all day long, it's like, you know, people like running ads. We'll teach you how to do ads. Let us do your ads on Facebook. We'll do, you know, like there's a bazillion, there's a whole cottage industry of people with Facebook ads, right? Guess what? I get them all day long. I must get 20 solicitations a day. I can't run them.
Yeah, it actually for the in the same way that you did, and it'll probably be the next thing you ask about, because you got in really early. You got in incredibly early, right? Like 2014 ish, from what I had read about, but
2015. Yep.
2015, right on. And I felt, although not that early, but around 2019 is when I started a lot of this media, and wanted to, for the sake of the stigma, be like, no, I'm going to use the proper term. I don't want to have to say like the pot show, because I know that's not going to be as bad for SEO. I want to correct things, responsible adult use, all the sort of ethical operations. And then I'm probably on my third Instagram account, and I haven't done anything impressive in social media, because on one side, I want to do more. I remember the first time they were like, hey, business account, throw some money in, we'll give you a bigger umbrella. And then they banned my account after taking the money because they approved putting the thing through and then told me I violated policy. My money. And so I was like, all right, I know exactly what this is. I sold weed illegally at some point, guys. This is hustling backwards. We all know what this is. And so remade accounts. And now in the same way, I'm just on the precipice of these great interviews, want to be able to spread more, and thought, you know, I might spend $10 just to get my account banned again soon. Why? It's like, if anything, is an experiment to say, like, you literally ask me to do this and then create a condition where you can't succeed, just like you were with
I get it all time. I get it all day long. They'll say, hey, you know, this is great. They'll actually, you know, they have these, all their bots and stuff running, right? Mm-hmm. Like Facebook will be like, I'll make a post and they'll be like, hey, amplify this post. If you pay $10 or whatever, you can amplify this post. And as soon as you do it, they go, oh, that violates community standards and shut you down.
It's like, why didn't you just not let me put the post up? Like, why didn't you just say your post violates community guidelines? You can't spend this. But I was like, of course, you always complete the payment. And in that way, I feel exactly the way you do with it. Where I was like, I can see this is driven by the model of let them pay and then we'll ban after. And I've seen it across so much media at this point.
I'm not going to get it changed. I got shafted big time by Google. And what was really interesting is Google welched out on me to the tune of about $24,000 in advertising. Cause I was also, I had been running sites like as a publisher, like running sites and with lots of traffic and stuff, and then putting ads and stuff in Google AdWords and things like that. The DoubleClick network and all that. And they ran, and there was one point where it was ramping up, and they ran my ads all month. The first month I did some tests, it looked good. So then I opened it up and I just ramped up the volume, and they ran my ads all month. And then when the month closed and everything was done, they shut down my account and didn't pay me. And it's a whole big long story. I was pissed. I was like, this is like, but if you read their agreements, because then I go back to the agreements, the agreement is basically there. You have to like to do any, to accept ads, to put their ad networks and stuff into your website. The agreement you have to accept, and it's one, take it or don't. Like in order to accept it, it has language in it, you know, like the click wrap agreement kind of thing. And it's got language in it that basically says they can do whatever they want. They can cease at any time. It's all in Google's discretion. If they don't want to work with you, they don't have to, blah, 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 and all this stuff. They basically ran it all freaking month. They didn't stop it like after day one. They let it run all month, rack up $24,000 in advertising, and then shut it off and didn't pay me. And I was pissed, but I was like, I don't have the time, the energy, the money. I'm not going to fight Google. I'm not going to win this one. And wouldn't you know, about 2 years later, I got a letter in the mail. There's a class action lawsuit for that very exact thing. They're like, you're part of it because you're one of, and you're not the only one. And it was a dirty secret that to tens of millions of dollars a month they were doing this.
Yeah.
Racking up advertising and then shutting people off.
Yeah. The smoke and the mirrors just in the.
I didn't follow up to find out, like, if you know what happened with that lawsuit, if you know the plaintiffs won or lost or what happened and whatever,
or if it's just an indefinite pushback due to COVID and all the backups.
Is it still just pending and all that stuff? And but it was, I found it really interesting when I got the letter saying, yeah, you're part of this class, and because you're not the only one, and this was a pervasive, widespread thing going on, a dirty little secret behind the scenes. I was like, wow.
Now, given how difficult, because you know I've experienced it, I'd say in a microcosm, you've certainly experienced it at a much fuller magnitude. Considering Canada's state of legality, I know Thailand went online recently. Actually, one of the growers I've spoken to before, he's over there cutting it up in like a aquaponic style of growth. For how much headache it's been, do you look at like new emerging markets internationally as an opportunity, or are you more so like America's tough enough, I'll just master here until further notice kind of thinking?
Yeah, right now we're just focused on the US, and even with Canada, right now we're mostly just focused on the US. And most of the reason is because of, we're still a small company, and just the logistics and stuff and the shipping and all that stuff. As soon as you try crossing the border, it never fails. Like we've got a sifter box. We have about 300 SKUs in our catalog, right? Mm-hmm. And essentially there's the armoire, and then there's everything else. All the other stuff is in this sort of like $5 to $50 price point, you know, and it's all these accessories, $10, $20, $30 widgets, you know, things like that. This might be, I don't remember the pricing exactly, $30, $40, you know, sifter box. We have different sizes and stuff. It's probably like a $35 thumping sifter box. So something like this, if it's a $35 item, and I've got the exorbitant credit card fees that I've got to pay and all that stuff, and I got to be boxed and packaged and blah, 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 and the cost of the product and everything else. And so I'm making a certain margin on it. And then I get, and then there's shipping. And, in the US, it might cost me $7 to ship that around. But if someone in Vancouver buys it, now it's international. It's got to go cross border. It's a different classification. Now all of a sudden it's like $20 shipping. And and it's from East Coast to what, you know, Vancouver, it's got to go all the way across the country and all the way up, and then it's got to go across the border, customs and all that stuff. And then sometimes it'll get there and then undeliverable or whatever gets returned. And then the customer's like, oh, you know what? Yeah, never mind. Just refund me, cancel it. You know, I'm like, I just spent $20 to mail that thing. You know what I mean? Like, we've had things like that, or it gets damaged. We go through all, we've had one that it took 2 months to get there. And by the time it gets there, the entire box is destroyed, you know? So we just found that trying to, like, these things, trying to go cross border and all that, it just becomes so expensive on the shipping side that it just, because, you know, if you're only making $10 on something and it's going to cost you 20 in shipping, and then they're like, oh, just give me a refund. And then you're like, we just, you know, it's like, and the product gets lost, you know, did not deliver, and you got to resend it again. It's just like, it's just not worth it. It's just really just for a small company. Now we get bigger and we want to have like a warehouse for distribution in Canada, like a Toronto or a Vancouver warehouse, and we ship product into there, and you know, that changes things. That changes the economics and so forth. But right now we're small enough and we're shipping out of our office, in the Boston area, we're shipping out. We're just concentrating and focusing right now. The other thing too is the armoires. That's now, those are also problematic for other reasons. We have a new model that we're working on right now that when we come out with that new model, it's going to ship easier and we might be able to go into Canada with that. We're kind of excited. We may be able to do Canada and Hawaii and Alaska. Right now it's contiguous 48 only on the armoire because of shipping. Like you can't have a cabinet, you know, a $1,500, $1,600 cabinet that costs, you know, $1,800 to ship. You know, nobody's going to buy it. It doesn't make economic sense. And is it going to get destroyed by the time it gets there? You know, it's got to get all this airfare or boats and all that stuff. So, but we have a new product that a new version that we believe we'll be able to ship internationally.
Right on. So that kind of reminds me in thinking, you know, some expansion and growth potential. I had read that you have like a 7-point criteria. Some of the things that seem to get you into, if I heard correctly in one of the previous stories, like the bowl fit it strangely enough. And I think a lot of people, if they read that, said like you had a criteria that a bowl happened to hit all the points of. That seems like a crazy criteria for a guy who wasn't trying to get into weed specifically. Yeah. How does this criteria work, or how does that help with sourcing product and thinking that way?
Yeah. So that was, this is how it all evolved. So remember, I was a software geek, right?
Right.
And what happened was I was a software engineer and I built software. Then I wanted to sell that software. So I had to learn how to sell and market it and all that. So I, putting on your entrepreneurial hat, you know, how to run a business, hire people, how to market and sell and do all the stuff, and then hiring people and building this whole, you know, sort of little empire. So what happens is over time, as you're growing or whatever, like I got to the point eventually where I wasn't writing code anymore. I kept hiring people to write the code for me. And then I'm running a business now. I'm not a programmer anymore. I'm a business owner. And over 30 years, it shifted where I've been kind of a serial entrepreneur, if you want to call it that. You know, built a business and then sold it, but the one business spawned off a second business. You know, kind of it spins off a separate related thing, and then you sell the first one, and then so you go through these things with a little course correction, and then kind of end up over here. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense when you look at the whole thing, but when you condense it all down, it's like, you know, I started off as a software engineer, and then my last business before Green Goddess was I was running a digital agency, a digital marketing agency.
Okay, right on.
But the thread there is there's a thread all through of what we were doing, because the software went to the web, and then we started doing more web based software and website type stuff. Then they need the marketing. They need, you know, so I spun off an agency group to work with that, and then sold this, and then just anyway. So I was in running a digital marketing agency for those last sort of 12 years, and doing a lot of web and a lot of technical and database driven web apps and things like that. But it was all part of a whole marketing agency, digital agency. And one of my clients came to me, and at the time he was the largest third party seller on Amazon. He had $1 million days. Oh, we did $1 million on Amazon today, you know? And he came to me and said, I want you to, and this was in the early days of Amazon, and their reporting was awful. And you couldn't really get a hint when at that scale, $1 million days, that scale, he just like, I need reporting. I need like just beyond whatever they can give me. I want to hire you guys. Can you go build a bunch of apps and build a special, you know, backend website that talks to Amazon through API calls and this and that, pull all my data in and then crunch it and slice it and dice it and give me the management reports and the things that I need to run my business? And he said, and when we were talking about all this stuff, there were things where he's like, I don't know how to explain the problem to you. I really don't know how to explain it. It's so complicated. He goes, you really just need to experience it. He says, why don't you set up a seller account and start selling and you'll see what I mean. And I remember looking at him like, yeah, two heads. I'm like, what? I'm like, that's a whole other business. Like, you want me to go launch a whole other business? Like, and go set up a seller account. I'm like, and we kind of were at an impasse for a while until eventually we got to, we kind of, you know, he says, look, I'll pay like all your time working on this other thing. It's a Skunkworks project. I'll pay you your time working on that. It's just part of the project to do this. And I was like, all right, fine. Let's do it. So we started an Amazon, we started selling on Amazon. And it, originally we were just selling, and then I'm like, I just need something to sell. Like, if we're going to sell things, I need something. He's like, I'll help you. I'll tell you what to, and he was into more like toys and novelties and kids stuff and Halloween costumes and things like that. So he's like, hey, here's some SKUs that sell well. Go sell these. This'll get you started. So we were selling like, slingshot rubber chickens. we were selling
novelties, definitely.
Yeah, rubber cockroaches, you know, and stuff. And just weird, you know, goofy stuff and a lot of kids' toys and stuff. But what happens is then all of a sudden, and we're trying to get this up and running. We're trying to, you know, and see the flow of inventory and see how the reporting works and all the stuff and get the flow going. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're out of inventory. Like they discontinued the cockroaches. Like, oh shit, well, we got it. All right, what else are we going to get? So one of the things is, and if we're going to run this, I don't want to lose money on it. So, all right, well, we're going to put in our best effort and actually try to be profitable. So we built a list of 7 criteria to look for in a product because we're just filling on Amazon. We're filling demand. People already are looking for rubber cockroaches and we're like, oh, well, we've got them here. You know, here it is. You're just filling demand. You're not coming up with some new weird widget and going, hey, does anyone want this? Nobody on Amazon, they're going there looking for something and you just want to be a seller who has it. Okay. Yep. So you're fulfilling demand, not creating demand. So we had this 7 points and it was things like, if you're doing Amazon and we were doing FBA, fulfillment by Amazon. So like you're packaging the stuff up and you send it to them, they fill the orders out of their warehouse. So like someone can come in and buy our little rubber cockroach, but they can also buy some, Charmin toilet paper or whatever, you know, or some, you know, an ice scraper, you know, a snow scraper, and they all goes into the one box and they get their shipment. Right. So we're doing fulfillment by Amazon. And when you're doing fulfillment by Amazon, you don't want to kill your margins with like all these storage costs and stuff in their warehouse, having all these big bulky things. So you look for things that are, is it small and lightweight? Is it under a certain size? Is there high demand? There are all these tools where you can look at what is the current demand for this? Like how many rubber cockroaches are being sold per day on Amazon? Wow, there's a bazillion being sold. That's all right. There's a lot of demand for that. We should sell those. So we had 7 criteria. Like, is it small and lightweight? Is it relatively inexpensive to us to buy the inventory? I don't have to buy stuff that costs me $1 billion. You know, is it
ties up all your capital? It's crazy.
Does it have, yeah. Can we manage with capital? Is there high demand? Is there good margins in it? Some things there's really high demand, but you're making no margin on it. Mm-hmm. You know, so is there good margins? Is there, what's the competition? So we had these 7 criteria that we put together and no product fit all 7, but like this one might hit 4. We're like, I don't know. This one hits 5. Oh, that's a possible. And, you know, if one actually hits all like 6 out of the 7, we're like, all right, take a good solid look at that. But anything from about 4 up, you know, of the ticking those boxes. And one day I had a young 24-year-old kid working for me, marketing, really good kid. And he came to me very clean cut, you know, and he came to me and he's like, I found the unicorn product. I'm like, what? He goes, all 7 boxes. I'm like, really? What? He's like, yeah. Like, never seen this before. I'm like, oh my God, it hit all 7 credit. Like, what? What is it? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, what? I said, I'm like, look at me, look at me in the eyes. Use your big boy voice. You know, what is it? I can't hear you. And he's like, it's a weed pipe. I'm like, oh, I'm fine with that. I don't care. Like, really? Like, yeah, I smoke. You do? Yeah, you do. I do. I smoke at night for insomnia, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, all right. I'm like, yeah, no, let's give it a whirl. So we bought them. It was the original bat, the old aluminum bat.
Yeah.
And they were small, lightweight. Like, I get a box this big, there's 2,000 of them, right? Small, lightweight, inexpensive to buy, good margins. There was high demand, moving tons of them. It was the unicorn product. So we bought those, we sent them in, we started. And what I did was I did a bundle. Like, instead of just selling a bat, I did a six pack. Because you went to a head shop, those things were like 10 bucks a piece.
Yeah.
So we did a six pack for $24. Like,
yeah, no brainer.
That's a deal. That'd be like 60 bucks worth. I can get them for 24 bucks on Amazon. And if I've got Amazon Prime, I even get free shipping. This is great, you know? We started selling a metric shitload, not even an English shitload, but a metric shitload. And and it went really well. And so we ran out of the slingshot rubber chickens. And Matt came to me and he's like, hey, we're out of slingshot rubber chickens. Is it okay to go buy more? I'm like, no. He's like, what, why? I'm like, for every dollar we spend, we get two back. So we cover our costs and we're making a dollar. On the bats, for every dollar I spend, we're making like five or whatever. You know, I don't remember exactly, yeah. But it was, you know, we're making five times the profit on those that we are on those. I said, go find me more of those. Oh, okay. I mean, if I'm going to do this, let's make some money, right? Like, right. Oh, okay. So he went and he started product searching more in that category. And then he found another type of pipe and then another pipe and another. And then all of a sudden we had, you know, 10, 15 different products we're selling on Amazon of all these different types of pipes and stuff. And that's when, I started saying, wait a second, what's going on here? You know, and I started noticing this. And then I was like, wait a second, you know, these are moving. This is a whole category that's moving. And there's something going on and there's demand here and there's something going on. And this is when I started really looking at the, because before I was like, all right, it was just some cute skunkworks project we were doing. That's not, we were just doing this as a side thing. I was a software engineer trying to build software products and API calls to Amazon. Or, you know, I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on over here? You know? And then that's when I said, and we were a marketing agency. So I always say, if you're a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. Humans, mm-hmm. we're biased. I'm a marketing agency. So everything looks like a marketing problem, right? So I started looking at this and I started looking at from a marketing perspective and realized all these, why is this successful? Why are people gravitating towards this? What's going on here? And realizing the holes in the marketplace, the needs in the marketplace. So wait a second, we should create a brand around this. You know, and that's how Green Goddess created. We created a brand, put a brand around it. There are other issues at the time too. Other people would come in and start selling the same product and try to steal our listings and all that. But if you create a brand, and then now we make, it's not just a grinder, it's the Green Goddess grinder. Now we're the only ones who have this. Nobody can steal our sales. They can try to compete with another grinder, but now they're trying to compete with us. They're not just people come in to buy this grinder, but they fulfill it. You know,
exactly.
I don't know
how
much money is on, but there's a whole thing where you can steal listings and all this stuff. So we said as a defensive move and all this stuff, and then looking at that, and then we're like, wait a second, let's elevate this. Let's go to the higher. So those initial pipes, some of them we still sell today because they were just popular and all right. We still have, but we didn't. We moved to let's get a higher quality, like these nice bamboo, you know, products and the rolling trays, and got into really nice higher end product. So we built a brand around this and went with it. But that's how it all started. It started as an Amazon thing. And then doing all this and getting into this industry and this business started building and growing, looking back and realizing this feels like the tech industry in the 90s. And, you know, and it was like, yeah, it was exhilarating. It was like, yes, it's the Wild West. There's a lot of problems, but there's a lot of opportunity and there's a chance to get in there and innovate. And then that's when I talked to Vincent about the armoire. It's like, yes, we can innovate. We can do all kinds, like sky's the limit of what we could do here, you know? And it's like, yeah, this isn't the same thing as a software industry. It's like every day is like the other, you know, it had mm-hmm. matured and flatlined after 30 years.
Yeah. That's incredible. So, as a final inquiry, if I could say, cause you've yeah. supplied with an incredible things to think about, thinking of the future as well, knowing that you've seen these two markets. I mean, the first one go to maturity, obviously we're right in the Wild West. I'd say like the first third of the Wild West of weed right now might be taking a close. Then we'll see what legalization does. And then there's what I consider that third generation of it, where it starts to kind of normalize and things move slow. right? Because the access is hopefully there.
There's going to be consolidation. There's going to be all that kind of, especially if national legalization comes, and then if you can start crossing state lines, then you have the big MSOs going to come in. There's going to be consolidation, and then it'll be run by Wall Street.
Yeah, definitely. As it scales up to and those opportunities become legal. Yeah, it seems to be the way a lot of markets go. So, well, I probably saw about half of the computer market because I was young enough to not have seen pre-computer market. You know, the 80s were a little bit foggy for me. But knowing with those two markets and their maturity, I kind of wonder what your hot take would be on AI, because I think a lot of folks think that is like the new big market potentially with, I guess, just the idea that is also low regulation. It's in a real proto form, I'd say, at this stage. Like, you know, been mentioned a lot, but only now are there like public access AI capabilities that you can kind of mess with. And I've seen a lot of the chat GP bot or whatever they have out there for it. Do you think that, you know, as we get closer to 2030, that might be that whole Web3 thinking and metaverse, like the next market, especially with your computer background? Or do you feel like this is Nintendo? We were seeing these middle technologies that maybe are just going to get us to the next thing.
I think that depending on how I answer that, AI has been something that, you know, I come from the software industry, right? So back to the 80s, we're talking about AI. Back in 80, I don't know what it was, 88, 89, when I was in school, I went to Rensselaer RPI in upstate New York, engineering school. I took classes in Lisp. I learned Lisp, which was an AI kind of language, you know, early AI stuff. It's been talked about forever, but it was always like the holy grail. Like, people doing some kind of cool stuff, but it was always like the holy grail because it required enormous computing power, and we've gotten there now. Like, the computing power is through the roof. I mean, you have like this iPhone has more computing power in it than what entire data center rooms had back, you know, 30 years ago. Yeah. And just that, you know, Moore's law, where it's just the capabilities just keep exponentially increasing and doubling and tripling, you know, year over year over year. So we have the computing power now to do real things that to do immense crunching, number crunching, and all that. Now they're getting into quantum computers and all that stuff, and that's incredibly insane. You know, because I remember the old supercomputers back in the 80s and 90s. You know, entire room size things cooled by like literally pipes of cold water coming through to try to cool these things down and all that. And now you have these quantum computers and all that stuff, holographics and quantum computers and all that. But AI, I think AI is going to become pervasive in everything. I don't know that I don't know that it's an industry. I'm not sure that. I think it's just still tech, you know. I mean, it's the tech industry. I don't know, it's a whole new industry. I see, and I could be wrong, very easily could be wrong, but I kind of see that AI is going to be a couple of companies that dominate it. It's going to be like Google owned search. You know what I mean? It's like back in the day, you had AltaVista, you had Yahoo.
Even MSN had a search in their MSN network.
Netscape. Yeah, they did later. I'm trying to think of the ones though that originally Yahoo, AltaVista, Lycos.
Yeah, Lycos.
Lycos. Here, Lycos. Good dog. There was maybe like four that were each legitimately doing their own, like building their own indices and all that stuff. I don't know. Today with all the consolidation, most people don't even realize that, like, you know, there's Google's about the only ones doing real search these days, and everyone else buys the search results from everybody else.
Yep.
You know, Yahoo is all powered by Google now behind the scenes, and, you know, and all that stuff. And they buy their data and all that, and, you know, and it's all really consolidated. For a long time, Lycos ended up it was Yahoo. And then Yahoo started just being powered by Google and MSN. It was Bing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they converted over.
I can't say today. I haven't kept up with it enough to know off the top of my head, but I know there was a while that Bing was just Google search, or was it Yahoo? Mm-hmm. I forget. But they were buying their Bing for the whole launch of Bing for many years. They were just buying their search from their search results and data from either Yahoo or Google. So It's really consolidated. I see the same thing with AI because like this ChatGPT thing comes out of companies OpenAI. They got like billions of dollars of investment money from like Microsoft and all that stuff. I mean, that's not just like you and I in our garage are not going to do that.
Right.
It's going to be a couple of companies, but then it's going to be pervasive. I think AI is going to be, and I'm a little concerned. I think a lot of people are. I'm a little concerned with that. The ChatGPT thing is really cool. It's really interesting. I find it as a software geek. I find it really interesting. But I'm also really worried about the ramifications of it because there's another one, a competitor. I forget what it's called. But it's the same kind of thing. It's a natural language. You know, it'll give you it'll search the net and come back and give you really, really persuasive arguments. Mm-hmm. But there's no filters on it. Like if it was just searching some conspiracy theory nut jobs website or whatever and pulling all the stuff together, whatever, it can give you very well-written, compelling arguments that are completely fabricated. Like, you know what I mean? So it's like all of a sudden you're like, no, look, this says, you know, it's like, because people are not discerning, people don't, you know, it's interesting. Like, well, who's the gatekeeper? Who's the filter on this? Like, you know, this AI could just be just completely making shit up. You know, sounds good, sounds compelling, but what are its sources? Where is it getting its, you know? So there's that. It's kind of like today, like the division with our politics, you know, red states, blue states and all the stuff. I think a lot of this is all driven by social media. There's a lot of great things about social media, but there's a lot of really not great things about social media. And one of them is that every idiot has a platform to publish. And it's really hard for the average consumer who's not paying a lot of attention and not doing a lot of research and all this stuff. You know, you don't have well vetted, like, it's not like the old days when I was growing up and your younger days where, you know, you had three news channels, you had ABC, CBS and NBC. And there was 1 hour, you know, 6 o'clock news, 11 o'clock news. And it was Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings. And you trusted them because it was all, they had entire newsrooms. They filtered, they sorted through this stuff. They verified things, fact checked things and compressed it all down to here's the news in 1 hour. Here's what's happened. Boom, you're done. Now you have cable news. You have just dozens and dozens and like every idiot with a, you know, can just publish, and you have people, you know, spouting conspiracy theories, and there's children being locked up in the basement of the Comet Pizzeria, you know, and yeah. It's like, you know, they don't even have a basement, you know, it's like this, it's all conspiracy theory nonsense. But now anybody can just voice that, and it's just out there, and other people, oh my God, look, I saw it on the internet. It must be true, you know. I think that's one of the downsides. One of the problems is social media is just now it's like nobody knows what to believe anymore. Nobody knows what to believe. And it's just, everyone's got different opinions. And, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And that's the problem is like everybody's facts are just all over the place. Right. You like that one?
I really do like that one. Yeah. I'm going to listen to this back and steal that one for another time. Yeah.
Steal that one. Everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. But facts, what is a fact? It's like, you know, I think my point, bringing this all back home, is that I think AI is the same potential that all of a sudden you're going to have websites, but what are they using for their inputs?
Yeah. You know, it reminds me in that Wild West style of things. And I kind of agree with you. I think it'll be more of a sort of background resource that a lot of technology will depend on in a silent way. Just in the same way that there's a lot of analytics that Google provides to so many companies so they can run, that doesn't mean that we understand the motivation of those actors. It's just supplying them with data so they can accomplish whatever goal. And I think that the chat AI bot, it isn't, I'm never one to demonize technology. I think Jefferson had a quote about like, it's not technology, it's education of how to respond to that technology that usually is the gap setter. And in the same way, every time computers ever accomplish something, especially in the heyday in the 90s, they blamed every problem on computers. You know, that's why kids don't talk anymore. And it's like, it's definitely a resource that can amplify poor behavior, but I don't believe it's the impetus of poor behavior. Again, the individuals are simply going to be motivated. They've always been motivated, but now they have a utility where when BlackBerry phones came out, and I remember seeing kids in high school first start to get into that tech, I was like, literally a Fortune 500 CEO can run their company with that. So there you are texting how you feel to a friend, which is fine, but the level of gravitas of the action is still that of a Fortune 500 CEO. Like, you feel that important. You give me a Ferrari tomorrow, I'm going to feel a little bit better than I did today driving a crappy Honda. because it still comes with all of those other trappings of wearing the cape and scepter that still existed beforehand. So my brain doesn't have the ability to upgrade like a DLL file or a Windows service pack would. It takes forever for me to be able to attune to that. And I think that sort of my generation being like an older millennial, but still very much millennial, sort of the last of the analog days, where because we have the ability to know nuance between what is digital and what was before, you can use it like the library that the internet is supposed to be. Just use it for research, get forms of information for, and then reach your own opinion. Whereas now with chatbot, especially, and how lonely people are, there's an unfortunate need. It's going to fill. It's going to fill no matter what we want, right?
You know, it's funny too, is I this just happened this week, a couple days ago. I made a statement. I have two children and they're twins. So, and they're just about 24 now. They're 23, almost 24. And the Gen Z. And it was funny because I was making a comment in passing. I was talking about someone and talking about, I was expressing how someone is not very technologically inclined. Okay. Mm-hmm. Kind of a Luddite, you might say, you know? And I used the phrase, I said, well, you know, her VCR still blinks 12, you know, her VCR probably still blinks 12. Right? And my daughter just looked at me like, I don't even know what that means. And I was like, oh yeah, like, you know, complicated it is, you know, like older generation people who can't program a VCR. And she's just looking at me and I'm like, you ever programmed a VCR? And she's like, what's a VCR? I was like, oh my God. And I'm like, wait a minute. What do you mean? Yeah. She came along. There were already DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
Really? She remembers DVDs. Now it's all streaming. There's no physical hardware anymore. Right. I don't even have a DVD player. But when she came along, it was DVDs. She doesn't even know what a VCR was.
So that means that the save button being the diskette still, you know, there was that old conversation. I'm sure you've heard it plenty of times in your background of like, kids know that means save, but they don't know why it's a save button. It just looks like a weird square that they've never had to utilize going through the days of, you know, B drive, A drive, and then to HD discs. I remember that sad couple of years.
Yeah, they'll say things like, you know, they'll say like, where's the clicker? And I'd be like, do you know why it's called the clicker? I have no idea. Because it doesn't click. Like, I don't know. I'm like, because the very first remote control for my TV, the wire went down the back of the TV under the area rug behind the bed, came up onto the nightstand, and you clicked to it was a physical switch to shut off the power so the TV would go off, and you click it. You had to click it on and click it off. And they're like, what? I said, yeah. And then that evolved into more like infrared remotes, but they were still, you know, you had on, off, and channel up and down, you know, and then now it's all Wi-Fi. Now they just use their smartphone to control
the app. Yeah. Which is incredible.
I'm like, where's the clicker? But then I'm like, do you know why it's called a clicker? No, because you used to click, click, click. It was an on off button. It was like a wall switch, you know, click, click.
Yeah. And although I wouldn't say it's a hard, fast rule, I would say that my dad was born in 37. So my dad was 50 about when I was born. And he did, for better or for worse, purposefully drag me through every technology from like an original mechanical typewriter that you just jam the keys, and then I had to keep fixing them because I loved jamming them. The suitcase version that was semi-electronic, through the word processor, like to Windows 3.1. And in that way, I could actually appreciate like a quiet keyboard because, oh my gosh, like when you have a full keystroke in like an early 91, 92 keyboard, and you realize that weird beige, the color that it had, like never helped you do function keys, never really understood how to use Prodigy as well, but then got to graduate through the tech. And if there's one thing I wish we could throw out there, cannabis included, because for me, the Armoire would do that for growing, is something to just guide people through those steps so they can appreciate. Same way, if I grew weed, I'd probably love the fact that the weed I've gotten has been so good up to this point because, oh my gosh, what a tribulation to get it done. And I feel like tech could have the same thing. We're like, I'm not saying use a typewriter, but at least be exposed so you can arrive here with the possibility of maturation. You know,
I learned to touch type on an old manual. And all about it. Ah, crap. Or nothing like you'd be doing a term paper, you know, and it had that, you know, error free and you couldn't, no corrections or whatever. Like I had some hard ass teachers and, you know, you get all the way to the bottom of the page and you're like double, and you're like, ah. throw it out, put a new page in, start all over, retype the whole thing. You don't have the same page 19 times to get it perfect.
Exercise in patient futility.
Yep. Fun, fun, fun.
Well, that is awesome. Well, Eric, I want to thank you very much for making the time being on the show. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It's very easy. And your stories, I have to say, I would plug you for even more in the future. I might just double tap you for it because the wealth of experience you have getting into the market. And even for me as a person who wants to be innovative or early to the opportunities I'm creating, I struggle sometimes with the same level of energy of like, where's the need? Where's the marketing? So it's an inspiration hearing a lot of that logic from you and very helpful, I think, beyond even me, right? To a lot of the listeners we have out there. So to everybody out there, thanks also for giving us a listen. Be sure to check out Eric's company, Green Goddess Supply, at greengoddesssupply.com. Before I get out of here, Eric, any parting words you want to throw out there? Anything that we missed that you wanted to include before I...
No, thank you for having me. And I just tell everybody to check out the professor. You did a great job in Money Heist. Loved it. And I don't know if you've seen it.
I appreciate you. I appreciate you big time.
But no, thank you very much for having me. And I'd be more than happy to come back. It was a good chat. Good chat. Thank you.
But to everybody listening, we'll be back with more cannabis interviews and topics for you within another calendar week. As I said, big thanks to Eric. You can expect to see the video releasing, I think, on the Thursday after this drops out. And be sure to check us out at uschamberofcannabis.com or on Instagram at uschamberofcannabis. That's everything we have for you today. So until next time, from the professor and Eric from Green Goddess, be sure to grow knowledge and extract truth. We out, everybody. Thank you so much.